crazy today. They're trying to just wrench your soul from your body through your tear ducts. I don't know what's happening. I am fantasy and paranormal romance author Leslie Penelope, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Hello, friends. Today is Sunday, May 14th, 2023, Mother's Day, and this is episode 217 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. And happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. I was wished a happy Mother's Day for my furry parenting duties. I just want to express gratitude for all the different ways that mothering takes place in our lives. So this week's best thing is, this past week, I went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the Smithsonian in downtown DC, with some of my very, very favorite people, Inez Johnson and Cerise Rennie Murphy. They are my mastermind sisters. And Isis Asari, who is the proprietor of Sister Sci-Fi, which is an online bookstore featuring African American sci-fi and fantasy writers, specifically women writers. So I have done events with Sister Sci-Fi before, and when I saw on Instagram that Isis was coming to the DC area, I wanted to meet her, and I basically invited myself onto this trip to the museum, and we went to see the Afrofuturism exhibit at the Smithsonian. And this opened a few weeks ago. I was in New York a few weeks ago at the Center for Black Literature up at Medgar Evers College doing that event, and it was specifically on Afrofuturism. So a lot of the people there are actually featured in the museum in different ways. I got to hang out with Yutasha Womack, who is fantastic. And she is in the video that you see right when you walk into the exhibit. And yeah, so I was excited to go once I learned about it. And it was wonderful to have this experience with friends old and new. And my thoughts about the exhibit, it was really interesting. So they take you through, you know, so when you walk in, there's a video with several people, including Octavia Butler and George Clinton, John Jennings, who did the graphic novel of some of Octavia Butler's work. There's also Alondra Nelson, who's a professor, and Yutasha Womack, like I mentioned before. And so you get this overview of what Afrofuturism is, which was fascinating. And one of the most impactful quotes from that video was from the person who actually coined the term Afrofuturism, who is, I can't remember his name, it's Mark something, and he was in the video as well. But he said that Afrofuturism is the excavation of lost tomorrows. And there was another quote that I wrote down, was that race is a technology and a science fiction. And both of those things I just thought were just like mind opening, you know, thinking about the excavation of lost tomorrows. When people try to categorize my work as Afrofuturist, I sort of take a step back. Like, I feel like that's become just a marketing term. I'm not really futurist. Now, Afrofuturism can incorporate the past as well, but trying to label every Black speculative fiction as Afrofuturist never really resonated with me. Like, I appreciate it for what it is. And to a certain degree, it is kind of what you want it to be, you know, like, so you can have definitions of it, but just like anything else, it's an energy, it's a vibe, thinking about what would our tomorrow have been? What could it have been without slavery, without the legacy of racism, without the apartheid system, you know, like, that's really powerful, excavating lost tomorrows and imagining them, imagining these futures the way they could have been if these other forces hadn't encroached. So that was my big takeaway. But the exhibit itself, it goes through a little bit of literature. There's a lot of music. There are costumes from movies and TV shows. There's a comic book section. And then there's a whole Black Lives Matter section, which I feel is a little controversial. Like, we were talking about that amongst ourselves, and it was a surprise to have Black Lives Matter and Trayvon Martin and images of protests and just a whole section of the exhibit on that. And they do explain it. I still feel like it was wedged in. I mean, if you're thinking about the excavation of lost tomorrows, then yes, people who have been murdered by the police, unarmed Black men and women, then you can see where they were going with that. I still think that it's a little bit of a stretch, but it's neither here nor there. It was a very powerful part of the exhibit. And so, yeah, if you can get down to DC and go to the museum, the entire museum, this is the third or fourth time I've been. So we only went to that exhibit because I had done the other parts more than once. And you need more than one day to do this museum. You need to be emotionally prepared for this museum in general. So we kind of kept it to the lighter parts, to the upper floors, because you basically, if you haven't been, you start at the bottom. Like it's 8 levels of museum, I think. And so you take an elevator down, you start at the bottom, which is Africa. And it takes you in this, the exhibit is very spatial. So it's narrow. It's like a slave ship at the bottom. And you're walking all these exhibits, takes you through slavery and then all the way up. And you kind of go up through the years. And, you know, I know, I think one of my friends was like, she didn't make it past Harriet Tubman the first time she went. Like she had to bounce out. You have to, like I said, emotionally prepare yourself because it is extremely emotional. Like Black history obviously is rough and being ensconced in that. I remember the first time I went, my mom's partner was like, I don't want to see any white person for like a week after going through this museum. It brings up all kinds of emotions, a lot of anger, a lot of sadness, a lot of grief, and a lot of rage. And so that is part of it. And going back to the museum and experiencing something that's more joyful. And the upper levels are all different, and they've got a variety of other kinds of exhibits which are less emotionally impactful and draining, but still really fascinating. And yeah, I don't know exactly how long it's going to be here. I will link to the museum's website in the show notes, but this specific exhibit was really great. And I'm glad that I went. I'm glad that I went with people and we could talk about it. And there's going to be posts on the Sister Sci-Fi socials, and one went up. I will link to that also. I think there's going to be some more from our time there. And yeah, it was a good experience, and I'm glad that I went. This is the second week plotting Brutal Fortress, which is the third book in my Bliss Wars trilogy. And it went really well. So last week I outlined everything I did. I will spare you from that this week, but I will give you a brief overview. So this week was about fleshing out the synopsis. I had a brief synopsis on Monday. I got, you know, the basic points. So I took what I did last week, which was the 7 plot steps from this specific story structure, wrote it all out, and then over the course of the week, expanded upon that. Continued doing character work a bit, continued working with ChatGPT to flesh out some ideas and just give some suggestions for brainstorming, talked to people, got some great brainstorms from actually communicating with other human beings. I was looking at locations. So this entire series takes place in an alternate world version of San Francisco. And they have the Trans-America Pyramid, which is an icon in San Francisco, heavily features in the first 2 books. This book widens the world a little bit. So we're going to Oakland. Now, I lived in Oakland for 2 years when I was in graduate school. The Bay Area of California is one of my favorite places on earth. So part of this week was looking at, where am I going to set this? Like, I have this Beauty and the Beast style story. I need some kind of castle or estate. And I was looking at, my first thoughts were the Paramount Theater or the Oakland Theater, like some of the, I like theaters. And then I was just looking on Google Maps and the street view of where I used to live, like something around the lake, Lake Merritt. Do I want to do something downtown with the iconic things? There's nothing like a transatlantic pyramid in Oakland. Is there anything iconic that I could use that would, you know, be an analog in this world? So that kind of work was happening. Then I was going to take my synopsis and do a scene outline, which is important to me. And I do it with varying degrees of detail in every project. So I'm feeling like this is moving really smoothly. I think I can do a fairly detailed version. So my first step was to try the software Plotter. Now, I've recommended Plotter before. I am an affiliate. If you would like to try it, I have a link. And I do like Plotter for certain things. But Plotter requires me to make more decisions than I was comfortable with at this stage in the process. You can choose from different templates for your structure. You can choose different scene templates for each scene. There's character templates if you want to keep your character profiles in Plotter. It's really a cool software, but I didn't want to make all of those decisions. We have a limited amount of decisions we can make every day, and I wanted to reserve my decisions for the actual story. So I played in Plotter for like 10, 15 minutes, and I'm like, this is not sparking joy. It's not resonating with me right now. So I just went to a simple spreadsheet. I say simple, I mean, it's part of my multi-tab spreadsheet, but I just have an outline. And I had certain columns that are in the template version that I start with for every project, and then I customize the spreadsheet with each book. So what I'm tracking in the spreadsheet for each scene has changed. I added columns along the way. I thought I was going to take some away, but it's been working. So this is what we have done. Okay, I'm tracking the POV. The POV character, so it's Selena and her love interest, Beauty and the Beast. The goal, the character's goal, their motivation or stakes, the method that they're using to achieve the goal, conflict, the turn of the scene, so how, what changes, the reaction to the turn, whether the turn is a yes but or no and I can talk about that a little bit more in a second. The decision that they make after their reaction, the value at stake, the polarity shift, and then the setting. And so I'm kind of using a couple of different methods. So goal, motivation, and conflict are pretty standard. I recommend this book to all early writers. If you have not read Deborah Dixon's GMC, Goal, Motivation, Conflict book, Run, Do Not Walk, to get that, super foundational. I think it's required reading for every fiction writer, in my opinion. Then I have this worksheet that I use, this reference sheet that I keep in my desk, and it's for scene and sequel, and I have no idea where it came from. I did not, unfortunately, give any attribution to it, which I try to usually when I have a worksheet, but it lists not just the goal and the conflict, but the method used to achieve the goal and gives different options for it. It also lists the disaster, which I call the turn, because disaster has a lot of weight behind it. Although sometimes it's helpful to think of it as a scene disaster. I remember I was taking a class with the author C.S. Lakin, and she said every scene requires a death. I think that's what she said. So turn, disaster, death, however you want to frame it. Sometimes it's in each scene, it's helpful to frame it in different ways. I'm using turn because I'm trying to keep it a little lighter, and just it makes more sense right now for me. And that just means, and the turn is hard for me. I know that each scene has to change in some way, but what does that really mean? There's an article that I go back to again and again, and I've talked about before, by an author, I think is Lee Allen Howard, which is a really good description of it. So I pull it out and I read it several times during the course of plotting. And so I did that again. And something clicked differently for me this week than has before. I realized that these concepts of a turn in the scene is changing, a polarity shift in the scene, which I first learned from either, the downside of being in this space is that I don't have my bookshelf behind me, so I can't remember all of the names of the books. Story by Robert McKee, and then Sean Coyne's Story Grid is based on Story by Robert McKee, and they both talk about the polarity shift. So the value at stake is shifting, and that is what the turn is. So for an example, I'm trying not to spoil anything. Our hero, this is a scene where his goal is to save a woman that he hears screaming. He has the ability to save her. His motivation is, if he doesn't save her, he'll feel guilt for reasons. The method, he has a power that he can use to save this woman. So what changes in the scene? This is a scene about someone who's trying to save someone who's in distress. What is the conflict? The conflict is this woman who he saves needs to get out of here because the danger is still present, but she does not want to because she has her own goals in mind. So he's saving her, but she won't leave, right? She won't go with him. What is the turn? The turn is that he kidnaps her and leaves anyway. He's like, you're getting out of here. I'm taking you bodily by force. In order to figure out what changes in that scene, you have to know the value at stake, which I think connects with the method connects with the motivation and the stakes, right? So for me, this character, our hero, one of his overarching over the story, his values is protecting others. So the value at stake in the scene is his ability to protect others. That value has a charge, positive or negative. At the beginning of the scene, he hears the scream. So I have it as negative. He hasn't protected anybody yet. You know, by the end, it's positive because he successfully protects this person. That I marked down on my spreadsheet. The turn is when it goes from negative to positive. So because the conflict is what's keeping it negative, he's trying to save her, she's not trying to leave. Negative in his ability to protect her. When he decides to just take her and grab her and leave against her will, that changes his value of being able to protect her to positive. That is the turn of the scene. Somehow, after all these books and doing these charts multiple times and recording something, like I was putting something in these columns, it never connected for me that way. That I've always had trouble figuring out the value. Like, what does that mean, the value at stake? And the value in each scene needs to connect to the larger character arc, the progression of this character. So this character, you know, his whole thing is, can he protect others? His wound relates to that and being unable to protect in the past and feeling guilt over that. And, you know, the climax of the story that I have mapped out is, you know, can he protect? What is he willing to sacrifice in order to do that? It's also having to do with altruism versus selfishness. What also helped this click for me was reading a few articles about the story grid, because I was thinking about the genre. So in Sean Coyne's concept book podcast universe of story grid, which is ever expanding and is harder to get into. And I do recommend the book Story Grid, although it is complicated with caveats, you know. But I was talking to those other writers, it's gotten really complicated now, so it's harder for me to recommend it. Anyway, I still do find it helpful because I got in early and I feel like I understand it. So I was reading some articles about his version of genre, and it's a slightly different version than, you know, mystery, thriller, fantasy, sci-fi. He's got internal and external genres. And each of these genres have values. So the action genre, the value at stake is life or death, usually. In the romance genre, the value at stake is love to hate. There's different values like this. Now, the internal genres he has, status is one of them. And status's values are failure to success. And morality is one of them. And morality's values are selfishness to altruism. There's also the worldview genre, and the values are naivety to sophistication. And so I knew that my heroine's internal genre is status. Her whole story is about failure or success to achieve this goal. My hero's internal genre is morality. It's selfishness to altruism. And I read the article, so he breaks down each of these genres and tells you all about them. I'll link to this in the show notes if you're interested. But I was searching for these values. I know it's action and I know it's love on the external side. And I had done some character work for the character arcs, and reading through the different options, I figured status and morality. That gave me values for their overall character arc. So I could bring those into the scenes and understand that as part of my hero's morality of selfishness versus altruism, it also aligns with this protectiveness. And at a certain point, he is going to have to decide whether to sacrifice himself in order to protect others, specifically this woman that he is in love with. And that is how I connected, you know, the wound where he wasn't able to protect someone in the past, triggering this sort of moral crisis of how can I ultimately protect her and everyone else? And what am I willing to do? And how will it harm me? You know, am I willing to harm myself in order to do this? So yeah, back to the sample scene. We have this value shift of, in the beginning, you know, running into the conflict, which makes the value of protection negative. The turn is when it changes to positive and he takes an action that is, maybe morality isn't the best word for kidnapping someone, but he's doing it for her own good, right? This is romance. It's allowed. His reaction, you know, he has this hope. There's a reason why he's hopeful after he kidnaps her. He feels a spark for this character. And then we have the yes, but, and no, and, which I call the turning point. So I have one column called turn and one turning point. We can call them different things, but this came from somewhere. You hear this a lot. Like, and this is in reference to, does the character achieve their goal? It can either be yes, but it causes some other issue that moves us into the next scene, or no, and we have some other issue. They create a new goal that they decide on. And so for each of the scenes where they're taking action, I'm doing a yes, but, or a no, and. So this, yes, he does achieve his goal of protecting her, but she hates him because he kidnapped her. Then we have our decision. The decision is basically how you get into the next goal for this character in the next scene. So he decides to take her someplace. And that is my whole row for scene two of this book. Then I have another column for the setting of where it takes place, and I have to figure out, you know, these locations, try to do some work on making the locations do more work, have more conflict or tension in them, do world building work. Susan Dennard, the author, she's a YA author whose newsletter I really like. She had a great post about improving your settings, and I will link to that. She is a gamer, so she uses video game analogies and metaphors or imagery, whatever, which is really helpful. Even though I'm not a gamer, and she has a really good example in there. That was an excellent post, and it's only part one, so part two is going to be coming, so definitely check that out. But yeah, that was the process. I got to scene 20 this week of doing that for them all, and that takes me over two-thirds-ish way through the book. So when I get back to it on Monday, I will outline the rest of the scenes and then probably do a little bit more, some of the setting work. I haven't quite nailed down the setting in Oakland for where they're going to be. Like, what is this beast's castle or palace or estate? If anyone is in the Bay Area and has any great ideas, like, is there a place that looks like a castle? I did some Googling. I found some houses that look like castles. So that might work. I'm still working it out, trying to figure out what I want it to be. But overall, I had a really good writing week. The plot is there. I could start writing. I'm going to do another day or two of prep just to shore up some things. But I know I always discover things in the first draft. I do fast drafting. I write the first draft as fast as I can. And that allows me to tap into the pantser side of me that discovers things as I write. So it's really discovery writing. So, you know, maybe as I write, I will, something in my subconscious will remember some building in Oakland or make something up, because it is an alternate version. So it doesn't really have to be a building that exists in our world. I just think it would be nice if I could find something that fits. Otherwise, I can be like, oh, and then they just built this one in this other world. It's slightly different, you know? That works too. I like to cleave to reality when I can. I like to have that box to work inside of. And yeah, I'll be drafting probably by the end of this week. I don't think that I need to do detailed character work. I don't usually like to do that before the first draft. I like to discover the characters in that first draft and then before the revision, do detailed character profiles. So yeah, I'm excited for what's coming up. In other news, I watched all of Queen Charlotte on Netflix. I binged it. It's only 6 episodes, but it's intense. I know a lot of people are really loving it. There's things I love about it, but it was a rough watch. Excellent performances, complicated storytelling. I mean, you know, Shonda Rhimes actually wrote, I don't know if she wrote all of the episodes. I stopped paying attention to the credits, but she wrote several of them. And all the acting is amazing. You've got these Black women being given really good meaty parts about complicated personal life things and choices. There's a lot of bittersweet. There's a lot of sadness. There is love too. There's friendship. There's sisterhood. So it's worth watching. And I would say tell anyone it's worth watching, just with knowing that it's not just your average romance and they're dealing with other stuff. And some things feel wedged in and some things are more natural. And I have questions about like the motivation behind the series, but ultimately, I did enjoy it. I binged and then I need a break. After like the first 3 episodes, I was like, whew, I have some more time, but I do not have the emotional stamina for a lot more of this right now. So let me take a break, watch something lighter. And then after I finished the series, I texted my friends. I was like, I have to watch something very rom-com-y to cleanse my palate after all of this like weight. So I watched Leap Year with Amy Adams and Matthew Good, which is a favorite of mine. I've seen it several times. I wanted There's Only One Bed Story. And that's one of the best There's Only One Bed movies, rom-coms that I can think of. So anyway, palate cleanser afterward, leave yourself some time because it's heavy. It gets heavy. We also went to see Guardians of the Galaxy 3, which I actually did enjoy a lot. It has personal stakes, you know, so the whole focus of this is saving one of the team. And for me, that just is more impactful than saving the universe, you know, like personal stakes, bringing it back to this is my best friend who is dying. I need to save this person. It's just more meaningful, you know, and they started the movie with Creep by Radiohead and they ended with Florence and the Machine. And I guess they finally got to an era of music that I like more than their previous eras of music. Like, I like oldies, it's fine. And I guess Creep is probably considered an oldie now. But really, it's the acoustic version of Creep. It's one of the best songs of all time. And yeah, so I enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy. I thought it was, I mean, it's light, it's not amazing, but there's animal cruelty, so beware. Like, you have to really watch these movies these days. They're trying to just wrench your soul from your body through your tear ducts. I don't know what's happening. Oh, and if you are an audiobook listener and you've listened to The Monsters We Defy, I was interviewed with my narrator, Shayna Small, who is fantastic, on the Sci-Fi Talk podcast. It is available now, wherever you get your podcasts. I will put a link in the show notes. It was a great conversation. It was wonderful being able to meet her, even virtually, and just hearing a little bit about her process and how she brings these characters to life. That's the Audi Award-winning Best Fantasy Audiobook of 2023. I had fun chatting with her and the interviewer. And finally, I was listening to this YouTube video about how clutter can be like a trauma response. It was kind of mind-blowing. Now, this woman, she's not a doctor or psychologist or mental health professional. She's just a person who's been through things and got herself out of them or is on her path to healing or whatever and is sharing things. So that's the caveat. I don't know if there's any actual research to support the idea that clutter is a trauma response, but it resonated. And something that she said really resonated, because we're in like week 3 or 4 of me not having cleaned my office when I said I was going to, like, however many weeks ago. And it's needed cleaning for a long time. And I'm generally a cluttered person. Like, our house has lots of little pockets of clutter because both my husband and I are clutter bugs. And what she said in this video was that she declutters her mind twice a day. So she was talking not just about physical clutter, but also emotional and mental clutter. And when she said, "I declutter my mind twice a day," I was like, whoa. Like, I took a step back. I paused. I rewound. I was like, that is fascinating. You have changed my life in a way that I'm not even sure that I understand. I don't know what that means, but I like it and I want to do that too. And I know that she has some kind of course. I think it's like a free course. So if you're interested in decluttering your mind, I'll link to the video. I haven't taken it. I don't know what it involves. But just the concept of decluttering your mind has just shifted my worldview in really interesting ways. And I've been feeling like my mind is cluttered. I've been having this low-level buzzing in my head. And I'm getting things done, but I'm not feeling efficient. I'm not feeling optimized. And I really feel like this whole idea of mental clutter is powerful. So I will share that with you. Do with it what you will. I hope it helps. So yeah, my goals for the week are to get to writing the first draft this week and continue on that work. I've got a whole bunch of other things to do and plans and decluttering of my mind so that I can make things happen in a more efficient, like, way that feels good to me. And I have an event coming up, the Imaginary Book Festival. It's next weekend. So I don't know. I'll have to figure out when I can do the podcast. But I will talk to you next week and let you know how my mental decluttering has gone. I hope that you have a wonderful week and a happy Mother's Day. For episode show notes and to sign up for the Footnotes newsletter and get show notes in your inbox, go to myimaginaryfriends.net. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and watch the video episodes on YouTube. You can email me at podcast@lpenelope.com. And I would really appreciate a rating and review to help support the show. My Imaginary Friends is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. For more fantastic podcasts, go to frolic.media/podcasts.